Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Hey, friends and family of Sex with Simmery. We are so grateful to have your listenership. We have the coolest fans in the world. It's pretty much the best. And we hope that the love is mutual. If you are interested in supporting the Sex with Simmery media, either the website, the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/sexwithsimmery and become a supporter. For as little as $1 a month, you can be a regular supporter and continue to bring independent media that provides the kind of information that you want to have out in the world. Over here at Sex with Simmery, we have been doing this stuff for years. As you've noticed, we've got over 200 episodes. The Sex with Simmery website has been up since 2008. We've been giving you the goods for absolutely no cost, and we will continue to do so as long as we can. So thank you so much for your listenership, and we do hope that you will check it out. Patreon.com/sexwithsimmery. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I am redonkulously excited for today's guest. I am an absolute hipster for today's guest. And I say that because you can be a hipster for a person because, like, I knew her before she was famous. So welcome to the show, Erica Hart. How you doing?
I'm awesome. How are you doing?
I'm phenomenal. And I've been, so I just have to say before we get started. So you are, for the folks listening, they might know you as Instagram famous, as like lady in the newspaper. And we're going to talk about that some more. But I first knew you because you were in my class.
I was your student.
Yeah.
Yes.
Before we get to why you're famous, can we talk about that real fast?
Yes. So I have my master's of education in human sexuality from Widener University. And my first, very first class in my master's program was with you.
Yay.
Yes. And it's one of my most memorable experiences from my master's program. So what it was awesome to be a guest on your show.
Yay.
Famous woman.
So that particular group, do you still stay in contact?
Yes.
with that cohort?
We go hard for each other. Absolutely.
That is such a unique experience to go through with someone, because, like, I mean, I've done it myself. Like, I had my cohort, and it's one thing to go through grad school with people. It's another thing to go through sex grad school with people. So,
right.
Like, you get
Absolutely.
To know them in a very specific, unique way.
Yeah, and it's super tender, that first class. Because, so, you know, my other classes, I don't really remember all the students from those classes. I remember all of the students from my first class. And we all stay in contact. Those are my colleagues. Those are my friends. Some of those people came to my wedding. Like, we're just super tight.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing to try to explain the concept of, so what'd you do at work today, Simmery? I showed porn to strangers.
Exactly. We've watched porn together.
Yeah.
Lots of porn.
Yeah.
Some of my favorite porn you introduced me to. Thank you.
Really? Do tell. Do tell.
The poppycocks, the trans entities. I believe you showed me that. If not, it was in the following class. But either way, thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
That's
a fact. So, yeah, you have a master's, yes, and you are a sex educator. But let's talk about why you have, I don't know, how, like 50 million followers or whatever you're at now. You're like rivaling Beyonce.
50 million at all. So I went topless at Afropunk. Afropunk is a music festival in New York City. Every annual music festival, and I went topless, and it's particular, it's interesting, it's moved people because I have a double mastectomy. So I showed my breast cancer scars, and people were just like, gone crazy.
What prompted that choice to do that there?
Afropunk is a super safe space for me. I've gone every year for the past 6 years, and it was really... Afropunk is, you know, it's all about music. It's also a huge place to show your fashion. That's very like fashionable sense, like inside of like African like prints and things like that. But beyond that, also like punk mesh. So people, they super dress up and go hard. And usually they think about their outfit in like January, and the music festival is in August. And I'm one of those people. So in January, I was like, you know, I think going topless would make a big difference, because I don't see a lot of awareness for breast cancer for Black, young Black people, in particular young Black and queer people. And those are the community that oftentimes participates at Afropunk. So I was like, I want to do that there. It's a safe space for me. It's really a space of activism as well. So I know that it will most likely be received in a way where I'm not arrested or really taunted by anyone. So I was like, I'm going to do it. And I went back and forth in my head a little bit about it. But generally speaking, if you know me well enough, you know that once I get an idea in my head, it's kind of hard for me to let it go. And I'm just going to, I'm going to do it in some way, shape, or form. So it was hard first, and I wasn't leading up to even just right before leaving to go to Afropunk. I was like, ah, I think I might wear a shirt. And I actually wore a headscarf around my chest the first day. And I was like, still a cute outfit if I want to take my top off. And then when I got there, there was like this little voice in my head that was like, it's time. It's time to take your top off. And I think somebody who I think presumably cis man walked in front of me without their shirt on. And I was like, you know what? I have to take my shirt off right now. Like, yeah. It's just, there's no other option.
And how was it received like at the time?
It was received really well. People were like, a lot of people just stared, right? So there's definitely people who did not talk to me, but they just stare. But in New York City, nothing really phases people. So you, when you stare in New York City, there's like an art to it. You like kind of stare, but you're like looking off to the sides. It's not like this dead on stare, because that would cause fights. Like people will literally fight if people do that. So it's not like, but you can feel eyes on you, right? So people would stare. Some people would come up to me and say like, oh my God, you're so amazing. I love you. Thank you for raising awareness about this. Thank you for being out here in your truth. Some people came up to me and were like, what happened to you? Like, what happened? Which was alarming to me, because breast cancer is, that have very high mortality rates in the Black community. So it was surprising to me, and also like, wow, we really have to be talking about this, that Black folks did not know that, yeah, what this looks like, or what, you know, a double mastectomy looked like. So
yeah, you've mentioned that before. When you spoke at a sex event just a couple months ago, you were talking about the ways in which white supremacy has influenced, you know, the idea of who gets breast cancer, and and how that affects whether people are looking for signs that it, you know, they might have it. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, white supremacy is a system that works and infiltrates lots of different systems, media being one of them. It is embedded in our communities, in our culture, in the ways that we think. It's just insidious. So in media, you know, what the breast cancer narrative, it's like it's this white, suburban, middle class individual who has three kids and like a picket fence and, you know, really beautiful kitchen with an island. and then they get breast cancer, and then their whole world is shattered apart. And that's generally speaking, that's like the very like somber music, the violin is playing, and it's always perpetuated like that. And, you know, growing up, my mom had breast cancer and died when I was 13. So I knew I had an example of someone that did not look like the media looked like. But also as a Black girl, I'm used to the media not reflecting my reality. So when I got breast cancer, I was just like, you know what? I'm really tired of this. I'm tired of the media not reflecting what is true. And also understanding that, you know, Black people experience, you know, it's the, one of the highest mortality rates with breast cancer. And it's oftentimes linked to a media awareness not being linked, or just educating us at all, or not having just representation of all different bodies that could have this experience. So it looks like a white illness. And then people are like, well, I'm not going to go to the doctor. Just similar to like if someone was under the age of 30, They're like, I'm not gonna go and get a mammogram. I'm too young for that. Even doctors will even say I'm too young for that. And that's asinine because there's so many young people who get breast cancer, young people that get cancer, period. And it's really sad. And it's also just killing people. So I really wanted to just put myself out there on the line of like, look, like this really, this see you to see me. And I want you to see me beyond my illness, yes. But for now, see me for my illness and see that this could happen to you. But also see that like the Black people exist in lots of different shapes and forms, and we have many intersections.
I think one of the really interesting spins on this is the fact that not only are you raising awareness of like the realities of who gets breast cancer, but one of the first times I saw you speak on it was again another sex event where you talked about sexualizing it and how. And we've talked about this on the show previously with some other breast cancer survivors about how this idea that people who have breast cancer are like fragile and, you know, don't want to have sex and there's mm-hmm. just so many things. What was your experience with that?
So for me, no one talked to me about sex and breast cancer at all. When I was going through my treatment, I had already gotten married or I was about to get married. And even during that time, it was like no conversation about like what sex might be for me at diagnosis, during treatment, post-diagnosis. No one. I talked to social workers about like my, you know, mental health, my emotional health, but none of them were like, oh, and like, how is your sex life? If in fact you have one, no one ever engaged me in that conversation. My body was put in menopause to preserve my ovaries because I'm interested in having babies and chemotherapy destroys, you know, everything in your body. So, you know, menopause also does things to your just to your like sexual self, like how you think of yourself even. So that was also challenging for me and something that no one informed me of. I had to find out for myself. So there was literally nothing. And me going topless at Afropunk, I think I discovered for myself in retrospect was me reclaiming my sexual body. My body is my own, but also like this is also a body that I, you know, love to experience sex with, whether it be with partners or myself. And I didn't want to people to just see me or see breast cancer as some sort of like problem or just like you are defeated or like it's over or it's all pink and bows and whistles and like all you do is fight and you're a survivor. Like, no, we fuck as well.
So when you you now do a fair amount of modeling and yeah. I see a lot of it is, you know, about you know, body positivity and especially like the lack of representation of like brown bodies and queer bodies. Mm-hmm. What kind of response are you getting from people?
I'm getting a really positive response. I honestly thought that this, all this hype of me going topless at Afropunk would end, 2 days after Afropunk. I thought it would be over. And my partner always tells me like, no, this is just the beginning. And she still has to keep telling me that because I'm like, it's so hard for me to like understand why people are regarding me as one, famous, two, like a model. Like, why are you asking me to do photo shoots? Like, that don't make no sense to me. But I get that it's a body that's missing and they want to photograph it. I do benefit from pretty privilege. I'm super aware of that. So I get it. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to be here. But how they respond to me is like, I'm so much more than a model, I think. That's the response that it seems that I'm receiving. Because oftentimes I'm interviewed and it's a photo shoot or we're talking about my scars or just the fact that I take my shirt off. It like means more than if someone that has not had a double mastectomy. So I think that that's interesting where they're like, oh my God, you're so brave and just so courageous and you're so beautiful. And I love that you bear your scars. And even in me saying that right now, I think about it. It's just like, it's sort of ableist. Or it may just be ableist, period. I don't know how you can be sort of ableist. So just ableist, period, where it's like, I'm brave for taking my top off because I had a double mastectomy, but the person that does take their top off that has not is not brave. Like, I don't understand. Like, why am I brave just because I had a double mastectomy? I'm brave because I my body looks different. I don't know. Like,
I think there's an expectation that you'll get pushback. I think that a lot of people are afraid to do any number of things because they think that they'll get critiqued or someone will, I mean, effectively bully them. But like, has that been your reality?
No, I don't really get. Some people have said, you know, you can educate about breast cancer in other ways. I think you're just being nude and you just want attention. But literally, the people who follow me will attack the people. Like, I don't even have to say anything. Like, I'll see the message and I'm like, okay, like, that's how you feel. And I'll go back and look at it. And people are like, leave her alone. She's sharing the truth. It's like, don't mess with Erica.
What's also funny, like, the idea that it's an insult or somehow a shutdown to tell people you're doing something for attention as though, fuck yeah. I mean, people are, that's your job. You're an educator. You're like trying to bring awareness to a thing.
That's a really good point. Cause I think a part of me does feel bad when people, I think I've been taught to feel bad when you're doing something for attention actually. Or it's just like, why would you do, all you want is attention. As if that's a problem.
As if human beings don't need that.
Right.
Or that, like, there's no benefit to that. I mean, there's a difference between, like, if you're just being a raging narcissist and this was just to indulge, like, you need people to tell you you're pretty or otherwise you can't get out of bed in the morning or whatever. But, which would be sort of, like, a thing that's actually holding you back. But this is not necessarily the case. Right. You were a functional adult before.
Right. Absolutely. Such a good point.
So as in terms of being a sexuality educator, how has your experience with breast cancer shaped the way that you do sexuality education?
It's shaped the way in some it's I am definitely way more inclusive of all bodies more than I was before. So I'm just much it's kind of. I don't want to say that it's challenging, but it takes more to educate about to do sex education for me now, where I'm like, you know, do this and this and that activity only if you're able, or, you know, everybody's body is different and here's how bodies can look different. It's like, it's not just, there's no easy way to teach sex education anyway, but I can't even physically do a shortcut. Like, I'm just like, I have to include all bodies or it's just not going to work. So it just, I don't know. I think it like takes more time for me. Where I'm just like driving home for people that bodies change and bodies look different and that's okay and that's normal and having conversations about, you know, ableism and what that looks like and just making sure it's more than a chapter in or more than a section in a sex education class, but more it's just included throughout.
Yeah, I can speak to my own experience as a sex educator. So I started doing it when I was a teenager, and the education that, you know, is provided to somebody at that age is usually just like how not to get pregnant, how not to get an STI, you know, that sort of thing. Like, how do you know if you're gay? Like, those are the kind of things that you're allowed to even think about. And then going forward, you like learn about healthier relationships and like you start getting a little bit more nuance in there bit by bit. And even going through a program to be a peer sex educator as a college student, there was a lot missing. In terms of that kind of intersectionality and thinking about not everybody is a 20-year-old able-bodied, like, you know, maybe they include like some LGBT stuff, but for the most part, it's not really the focus. And then when I took my first course in sex and disability and the opening of the class, it was Dr. Carol Cobb-Nevelton, and she said, at absolute most, a person is temporarily able-bodied. And I was just like,
what?
I was like, oh, shit. All right. Yeah. And so what she was trying to say is that disability is not like there are people and then there are disabled people. She was trying to emphasize it's not that, that it's like understanding sexuality through the lens of disability is just like thinking about how everybody is different anyway, all the time. And we all have different needs and desires and limitations and just to stop thinking about this like goal-oriented, this is the correct way to do it, everybody should be able to do this, like that kind of thing. and being mindful when we're talking about just everything about that. So like, which sex toys are harder to use if you have arthritis? Like, what are options for people who can't necessarily like hold their own weight up? Or, you know, just being mindful of you know, the body image things that go with, let's say you have a colostomy bag or just like whatever. Mm-hmm. That there's an endless variety of human experiences, and it's not people and then other. It's everybody. And going forward, how your body works is going to change. It's just like accepting that, just knowing that that's going to be the case.
Yeah, that's awesome. See, look at you teaching me. Teach me.
Well, I don't have to grade you today, which is great.
Yeah, no grades.
Great. I really appreciate not having to grade. This is just an aside. This is just me venting because it's the end of the semester. But dang, I hate giving grades out that are not like everybody's happy. I want everybody to be happy, but they have to like turn in their papers.
Yeah, right?
They have to turn their papers.
Gosh. I'm about to start that life and I'm scared.
Yeah? What are you teaching now?
I'm going to be teaching at Columbia in the spring, a gender class.
Yeah, you are.
Mm-hmm. I'm super pumped about it.
So, yep. So what will that entail?
It's not a lot of like, there's two papers, but they're reflection papers. I threw some Widener stuff in there, but bring a collage in of your gender. That's all you have to do is just do it. Okay. Just bring it in.
That's
fun. And then a little bit of participation, but the reflection papers, you know, have to be APA citing and include resources and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, they're Columbia students. And what I've heard from the past is that they, you know, really are particular about their grades. And I know that oftentimes as educators, we want people to be more for the learning than about this letter grade, but I get it, being the person that was also in grad school not too long ago.
Yeah. There's so much about education that needs to change because like grade inflation and all of that. And it starts like from the jump. And this is kind of a tangent because it's not even about sexuality, but I was talking to my friend Dane Saint, who's a previous guest on the show. He came and talked about new ideas of masculinity where, developing a new concept of what is masculine power. So it's less about dominance and it's more about using your strength to protect and being in touch with your emotions and being able to handle them and that sort of thing. But he was talking about how we need to change the entire education system to be, rather than like, you are just placed with these people because you were born in the same year, to instead being like projects based and like, once you master these skills, then you move on to the next session of that class. So you might be in like math 4 and like English 6 and like social studies 1 or whatever, based on what skills you can actually demonstrate competency in. And I was like, oh my god, that would make everything so much better. And yeah, like how, like even socially, thinking about how much better like high school would have been if you hung out with people who were of a similar like skill set, not necessarily people who were like the same age as you, like how much of a game changer that would be for all of the experience. Like, why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, that's so real. That's amazing. That would actually be effective.
Yeah, let's just tear the whole thing down and start over.
Tear down.
So what are your plans going forward in terms of education stuff, like both the classroom thing and also just like using your position in the media?
The classroom thing, I'm just hoping to, I've always wanted to do a speaking tour, nationally, internationally, either one will suffice. And that's something that I'm working on and have a few schools and organizations, on the lineup for 2017, which I'm going to release here soon this week, I hope. So I'm super, super just, I'm just proud of myself, honestly, because I've just always wanted to do that. So doing that, and that'll be like me sharing my story. Like, it's called Where Are All the Black People? And it's just literally a walk through my life of where I asked that question at different times of my life, which is all of my life. And I also have created a curriculum called Sexualizing Cancer. And that is for breast cancer patients. And also there's a part of it that is for doctors. So I'm also speaking on that curriculum and doing parts of it at different conferences and such around the country. And just, I also am teaching, I've kind of gotten into like the charter school system in New York City where I teach, I'm teaching a fifth grade class right now, and they are just so amazing, teaching them fifth grade sex ed, and they are brilliant. And I'm hoping to teach this high school, charter school, in the spring as well, but we shall see. But I'm just loving this fifth grade class right now. I haven't really taught elementary. I've taught elementary in the past, like 2 or 3 years ago, but I would love to cultivate it a little bit more because they're just so brilliant and they're so much easier to teach. Adults are so annoying. Like little kids, I tell them that gender is in the brain and they're like, yeah, it's totally in the brain.
Well, you don't have to like unlearn stuff first.
Nope.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
They're just like, yeah, it's in the brain, miss. Yep, totally.
I am incredibly curious about the fact that you do education with kids, because like I feel like there's so much like clutching the pearls about like letting people talk to kids about sexuality, especially if there's any evidence of them being a sexual human being, adult person,
right? Yeah, I mean, I don't, this school was like kind of sought me out, actually.
That's
was asking
rad.
Around for sex educators. You know where it starts? It's schools want someone who can come in and do talks about bullying. Mm. And then what I'll do is I'll talk to the school. And what I find out is that they're actually having like sexist remarks or, you know, comments about bodies that are not positive, or they are having some sort of like homophobia or transphobia. And I'm just like, well, you need sex ed. Yeah. Like, yep. It is so clear that like at your very basis you are missing that completely, and you're trying to have these little mini conversations with the bully and the person that's being bullied, and nothing is going anywhere because you're not actually doing like a whole like overhaul of your school. You're not talking about it. So it's like, it's just a way to like sell it. But they often come with like a problem, and generally speaking it looks like bullying. So
yeah, I'm super curious about like the link between comprehensive sex ed and then like the weird ways in which people act out, which I feel like bullying effectively is just like acting out about your personal problems. Like,
yeah,
that sort of thing. So I don't know what the research is on that, like as a bullying intervention or a preventative measure like that. I know that David Hall, who is a human sexuality educator. He also has a PhD from Widener. He also does a lot of training around bullying. And his primary message is less about going after the bully and trying to change their behavior, because usually they know it's wrong and usually they like all the attention that it gets them for doing it. They're not necessarily the ones with the low self-esteem. They usually have very high self-esteem, which is why they feel like they can get away with it. And he recommends talking to everybody that is in between the bully and the person who is being bullied, like about the gradations to which people are a part of it. So there's like the people who are like egging them on and like, yeah, that's hilarious. And then the people who are just a step away, who are watching and not doing anything. And then, you know, to all of the spectrum beyond that, and like getting each one of those people to move one step further away from the bullying. To take them from egging on to just being bystanders, from bystanders to being actively like, that's not cool. Like, stop doing that. You're a jerk face.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So, that makes complete sense.
It seems like a good area of focus given also our president-elect. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, our president-elect just really speaks to just how the country has been for a very long time. So it's like,
yeah.
He's president and it's awful, and it's just reinforcing. Hopefully people will wake up and see like this has just been happening in lots of different ways. How is he even president, Tim? Like, how was that even possible for him to even?
Mathematically, it's because of gerrymandering and the stupid electoral college.
How is it possible for him to even be a considered candidate? I'm still there. Like, I'm still at
That's
that
a valid
point.
Question. That is a valid
that
Like,
valid I'm like,
question.
How were you even, how did you get past that point? Like, weren't there?
Well, he also has been trying since the 80s. And I think there's something to be said for, like, if you just have the budget to just keep trying to do
That's
something
real.
Over and over and over again, at some point, like, through name recognition alone, you're going to get carried past where it makes any sense.
Yeah, that's real.
I think that, I mean, and not to knock Hillary or whatever, but like she had name recognition for decades and decades and decades. And you can't buy that. Like, I mean, you can't actually. That's literally what advertising is. But yeah, okay. Let's stop talking about the election.
Yeah. We could talk all night with that.
I want to talk about something happier. Another thing that you have been discussing and trying to bring more attention to is polyamory. So can you talk about like that as your journey personally, and also like to the place where you want to talk about that to other folks?
Yeah. So I'm so interested in, I think I'm at a point in my life where I'm interested in talking about how I think about the world and how I view the world and how I experience the world, and not going quiet about it because I think people are going to think that I'm weird or different, or no one is going to agree with me on those points. And that is kind of where poly sits for me, is where one day I was like, you know what? I don't actually love in the same ways that everybody else does. And I want that to be acknowledged, even if it's just acknowledged with the person that I'm with. I want them to know that I'm poly, that I love multiple people at one time. I'm capable of doing that. That's something that I enjoy doing. I am a caretaker at heart. I love taking care of people, multiple people. That's just how I love. And I think when I educate, it's certainly something that I talk about. When I talk around the country, that's definitely something that I include, because I want, again, it's just another area where representation is super small. Like oftentimes when I see people talking about being poly, they are white, usually of a fluent background, and period, that's it. Like there's nothing else to it, or just very accessible to like education and things like that. When I was first learning about poly, it was when I was much older. It wasn't until I was in my master's program that I learned about poly. I did not even know it was a thing until then. And it was all white people talking about it. They all had narratives about it and experiences about it. And I was like, well, this is so strange. Again, like I must be, you know, black people that have also, and people of color that are poly and that participate in poly. So, you know, I'm just interested in taking up space. That's, I think, really how I feel about all that.
So what was it like for you to discover? What did that look like for you, that you decide that like this is a thing that clicks for me personally?
It was challenging because I spent most of my life cheating on all my partners. And I thought something was wrong with me. Like I was just like, I don't understand why I can't stop doing this. I feel always compelled to do it. I, you know, have traced it back to, you know, maybe it was because my mom died and I just want to love people. I'm just like, I don't know. I just feel like that's like an explanation of scarcity. Like I'm just supposed to be with one person, and I don't know that that's necessarily the truth. I don't know that that's my truth, that I'm just supposed to be with one person intimately, emotionally, physically, at one time. So I, you know, started reading up more on it. And at the time I was in a relationship with the person that I married not too long ago for 7 years. We're no longer together. But we opened our marriage, and that was really challenging because she was not interested in any sort of non-monogamy at all. So that was challenging to have conversations with her about it. And like, well, do you still want to be with me even though I'm not non-monogamous? And it's like, yes, I do. I do want to do that, but I also want to open our relationship. I want to explore that. And this is me asking to open our relationship after we had been together for 5 years. So it was super, it was a major shift in our relationship it was a major shift for us. It was like, I think any relationship that lasts that long, you grow and you change with the person. So you either grow with their changes or you grow apart. And for us in our particular instance, we grew apart in a lot of ways. We also had a breast cancer diagnosis. So there was just lots of things going on with the two of us. But I do think that opening our marriage was super hard for her. now she's like actively poly,
which that's interesting.
Yeah. Cause she was like such a no. And then when we opened our marriage, she's like, okay, I'll try this out. But like, I'm really just doing it for you. And now that girl is openly poly.
That's fascinating. That is really fascinating.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Huh. All right. So yep. It seems like, I've talked to a number of people in my life who are either, so I run at a scene that's fairly open relationships, poly, swinger, etc. Like that's yeah. just sort of the nature of my life. But the interesting thing is how many of them say, you know, like 5-6 years ago, I didn't know about this.
Right.
Or I had just heard of it or had seen right. it in movies or something like that. And now it's like the sixth
everywhere.
Sense. Now it's
oh,
just
totally.
Like, oh my God. And it's kind of like also when the L word came out, there was this
yep.
this straight boy that I worked with, and he watched the L word, and then he was like, oh, and now I see lesbians everywhere.
So it's like as soon as you have the awareness of something, then it's everywhere.
Yeah. So now it's like, is this where the world's going? What's happening? What do you guess? What do you think, like, 50 years from now, what will be standard relationship template?
Oh, my God. The standard relationship template will probably be, I don't know. I worked with fifth graders today, and their first question to me this morning at 8:30 in the morning was, what is a threesome? So the standard relationship model will be threesomes all the time. That's just normal. Like, sex educators will just, not that they're not normal now, but I feel like we always talk about two people sex all the time. But threesomes will just be a thing. Like, they'll just be what people do. Like, it's just, yes, I live with three people and we have sex all together all the time. Yes, we're poly sometimes non-monogamous sometimes. It's just going to be so varied that no one, you'll be able to get married and be poly. Like, what in the hell? Like, I'm waiting for that revolution to happen.
The next phase of marriage equality.
Hell yeah, because you can't do that right now, and that sucks. Like, when I was married, the partner that I was dating at the time used to say that she wanted to get married to me, and I was like, but I don't know how we're gonna do that.
I mean, it also depends on what your definition of married means, right? Like, do you need the government to recognize it, or can you have...
For her, it was the government's recognizing it. That's a good point, though. But for her, she wanted the government to recognize it in the same way it was with my wife at the time. Which just wasn't...
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, to me, like, so obvious that it's like, A, the government shouldn't have anything to do with it. Like, that's yes. the really obvious thing. Because it's like, No, you don't need to know. You don't need to know anything about it. You don't need to know anything about it. It's nonsense that affects, like, what country someone can live in. That's nonsense that, like, you know, like, it's just such a silly concept that anybody else's business. But, like, if we're gonna say that it's a legally binding merger of resources and stuff, then why can't you be a corporation? Just like corporations can be people, right. Why can't people be a corporation? Like,
it's control and money. Because then people yeah. get divorced and then people get tons of money. It's a mess. Also, getting married costs money. It's just all.
Also, who's going to be the senator that, like, comes straight out and is like, yeah, let's do this. And then they never get elected again.
Right. Ever.
Their states.
Ever. Like, what do you mean you have more than one wife?
Like, how different would it be? Like, all of the sex scandals of all the politicians who've cheated, that it turns out that, like, actually that was fine. Like, nobody was actually mad about it. Like, How different would everything be if you didn't have that, like, blackmail over people?
Right? I think also it just even inside of poly relationships, talking or just poly communities, like being poly, but then also just being participating in monogamy at that for the times that work for you. Like, yeah. I feel like I also am in a lot of circles where people in a lot of communities of poly people, and whenever that person is just dating one person, it's like, well, wait, I thought you were poly. It's like,
well, I think that's,
I am.
I think that's kind of like that's like being bisexual, right? Like, right. So exactly. If you identify as bisexual and you are, let's say, you're a monogamous person, and if you are currently dating someone of the same sex, does that make you not bi anymore? And if you're currently dating someone of a different gender, does that not make you bi anymore? No, I'm still the same person.
Totally. Same thing.
Or whatever. You know, you could be dating five people of whatever specific gender, and your orientation is not changed by that. So just want to throw something at the wall when I say that.
Mm-hmm.
Like hurl a bottle. Okay, so I want to tell everybody where they can find out more about you. So where can we direct folks to follow you, to book you for speaking things? Like, where do we go?
Speaking things. Sorry, my partner just came in the room with lots of booze and I was completely confused. So speaking things. I Heart Erica is my website. What does it matter? It's not cap sensitive or case sensitive. IHARTERICKA.com. You can book me for all of the things all of the time.
That's awesome. And then of course you're on Twitter and Instagram and
Twitter, my Twitter handle, my Instagram handle, they're both the same. It's at @IHeartErica. And then my Facebook, I don't know. I don't know how you handle the social media stuff, Tamari, but I have a likes page. I have a like page on Facebook that I've kind of ignored, and I have my like regular, degular, schmegular Facebook. I don't even know what the URL is for it, but people find me. So just Erica Hart. I haven't changed my name to like some, you know, funky something beyond my name, which would probably be
a great name though.
Some sort of alias. I think I might need an alias at some point.
But like, how are you going to get away from your name? Like, your name is fantastic.
So. It's so good. I love my name. I concur.
It's phenomenal. And the spelling is so great because it's like, how many other Erica Harts are there that are spelled the way that yours is?
Right? Like, that's what I think.
Like, I know for a fact I am the only Timory Schmidt on the planet, possibly that ever was, because it's a French Caribbean first name and a Luxembourg last name.
Oh,
the odds
gosh.
Of that
so
ever
real.
Having... Yeah, like, I have a Google lockdown on that. I got that covered. All right. Well, okay, so we have to get going, and I just I want to see if you have any more final thoughts you want to... tell people an idea you have, or just vent, or just say a random word. What's on your mind right now?
What's on my mind right now? I don't know. I'm super tired. I'm super grateful for this experience. I want to tell people happy holidays. And happy day, period. If you don't celebrate them, just everybody, all included. This is also a time where people experience a lot of depression and the mental illness kind of maybe at its like highest point, or maybe like a downtime. So I just send love to just all people that may be experiencing that, and to take care of yourselves. That's what I want to say.
Awesome. I love it. Well, I want to thank you so much, Erica, for fun and time for us and coming on the show, because I've wanted this to happen for a very long time.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So keep doing the damn thing.
Thank you.
And thank you everyone for listening, and have a fantastic day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.